Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Sir Max Hastings talking about Vietnam.
Well, now you know what a bloody awful television reporter I was in 1970. On the 28th of May, 1968, Michael Minahan, a 20-year-old Marine machine gunner in Vietnam, wrote to his folks at home. Today we are ninth day in the field, and there isn't much to say because all we were doing is walking in the mountains looking for goose. I thought I would drop you a line to say everything is fine. 5 days later, however, it stopped being fine. Minahan's parents in Marlborough, Massachusetts, received a telegram from Marine Corps Commandant, deeply regret to confirm that your son died on 2nd June. He sustained fragmentation wounds to the body from friendly airstrikes which fell short of the target area. His remains will be prepared, encased, and shipped at no expense to you, accompanied by an escort either to a funeral home or national cemetery selected by you. In addition, you will be reimbursed to an amount not to exceed $500 towards funeral and interment expenses. 16,899 such telegrams were received in homes across America in 1968. Over 300 a week. By the end of the war, in May 1975, 58,220 of Michael Minahan's compatriots had died, together with 18 Russians, 14 North Koreans, 771 Chinese, and more than 2 million Vietnamese. Around 40 for every American corpse, together with numberless more Cambodian and Lao people. This bloodbath in a succession of conflicts that lasted three decades far exceeded the human cost of the 21st century's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. Moreover, Vietnam made a cultural impact on its times greater than any modern strife. During its last phase especially, it roused the dismay and indeed revulsion of hundreds of millions of Western people, destroying one US president, and contributing to the downfall of a second. In the wave of protest against authority which swept the West in the 1960s, rejection of old sexual morality and an enthusiasm for pot and LSD became conflated with lunges against capitalism and imperialism, of which Vietnam appeared an exceptionally ugly manifestation. Moreover, many older Americans who lacked sympathy for any of those causes came to oppose the war because they saw themselves systematically deceived by their own government about an enterprise doomed to fail. The 1975 fall of Saigon inflicted humiliation upon the planet's most powerful nation. Peasant revolutionaries had prevailed over Western will, wealth, and hardware. The stairway up which on the evening of the 29th of April, fugitives ascended to a rooftop helicopter, secured a place among the symbolic images of that era. For me, as for all my generation of war correspondents, the struggle was among the foremost experiences of our careers. I was one of those who flew out of the US Embassy that tumultuous, terrified day. And even before I first saw Vietnam, in January 1968, aged 22, I was among a group of foreign journalists who visited the White House. We were addressed by President Lyndon Johnson about his commitment to the war. That morning, his personality seemed no less formidable for being close to the caricature. "Some of you like blondes, some of you like redheads, and some of you maybe don't like women at all," he declared in that deadweight drawl, gesticulating constantly to emphasize his points and making broad pencil strokes on a notepad before him. "I'm here to tell you what kind I like. I'm prepared to meet Ho Chi Minh anytime in a nice hotel with nice food, and we can sit down and talk to sell this thing." After making his pitch, this big man left the room abruptly without taking questions. We were preparing to leave when suddenly the president put his head round the door again. "Now, before you all go," he said almost coyly, I want to ask, do any of you feel any different from anything you'd read or heard about me before you came? We were stunned into silence by this glimpse of the awesome vulnerability of this President of the United States. In those days, Vietnam represented in the world's consciousness prodigies of both natural beauty and man-made horror. My book emphasizes that the struggle was above all a disaster for the people of Indochina, on which an American tragedy was overlaid. I interviewed scores of Vietnamese men and women, communist and anti-communist, as well as US veterans. I read thousands of pages of translated memoirs and documents from both sides. Let me recount to you a minuscule wartime incident, such as was repeated 10,000 times. One morning in August 1964, Lieutenant Phan Nam of the South Vietnamese Airborne was leading his platoon in search of communist guerrillas. As they trudged through a ravaged village, he saw a young woman sitting silent on the brick floor of a wrecked house, holding a wicker basket. Her eyes looked straight ahead in a blank, stupefied stare. Nam asked why she lingered in the midst of the battlefield. She remained silent, her stunned eyes emitting a flash of terror. Suddenly, as if performing a gymnastic exercise, she thrust out the basket towards me. It contained two sets of clothes, a headscarf, two gold necklaces, and a pair of earrings. A soldier motioned the girl away, but Nam called her back, holding out the basket. Her hands trembled so violently that she was unable to take it, and instead, sobbing, began to unbutton her blouse. The young man was deeply embarrassed. She had read his rejection of her most valuable property as a sign that instead he wanted her body. What kind of life had she experienced that she would offer herself to a soldier who could be her younger brother, while tears ran down her terrified face? Nam persuaded the girl to follow his platoon to a nearby river, crowded with sampans carrying fugitives from the fighting. People were calling out, among them a voice that screamed, "Lie! Lie!" This was a woman who recognized Lieutenant Nam's traumatized acquaintance. The girl stopped, as if she was trying to summon up a memory from a past life. Then she cried, "Mother, mother, our house has burned down. Our house has gone." The Southern officer described her walking away towards the water like a person in a trance. This is what wars, all so-called wars among the people, are like. For those, especially women, who are not fast jet pilots or SAS supermen, but instead victims, whether in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. Between 1945 and 75, such tiny tragedies were repeated countless times in Indochina. Foreign eyewitnesses concluded that most were the fault, first of the French, the colonial power, and then of the Americans or their South Vietnamese clients, unleashing devastating fire and air power. Yet a key theme of my own book is that blame seems rightfully to be shared with the communists, who committed numberless atrocities in pursuit of a revolution that wrought misery upon their own people. Photographs exist, which have become notorious, of a South Vietnamese police chief shooting dead a captured Viet Cong during the 1968 Tet Offensive, of a screaming child fleeing naked after a 1972 South Vietnamese napalm strike, of the homes of peasants set on fire by American soldiers. Yet the policy of omerta, silence, pursued by all communist regimes, well served that of Ho Chi Minh. No pictures were ever published of a Vietnamese being buried alive before his fellow villagers for the mere crime of being a small landlord. He pleaded for a merciful gunshot instead, and was told contemptuously by his murderers that they saved their bullets for the imperialists. No photographer recorded the thousands of innocents killed in cold blood and buried in mass graves during the communist occupation of Hue during the 1968 Tet Offensive. Nobody in modern Vietnam, where tourists are so warmly welcomed, is allowed to speak about the thousands killed as so-called class enemies during the early years of Ho Chi Minh's rule in the north. An American advisor named George Banville described a typical episode during the struggle in the south in which a Miss An, a typist at a headquarters in the Mekong Delta, was seized one night at her parents' home. Her head was beaten in with a rifle butt, her young brother stabbed to death because she refused to assist an attack on the US compound. The officer wrote, "She was maybe 20 years old, devout Christian, very pretty, very much a lady. My team used to sit on the porch in the morning and watch her stroll into work in a long, flowing Ao Dai with a matching umbrella protecting her alabaster skin from the sun. She ignored their stares, and you could only guess that maybe she disliked these foreign devils admiring her beauty, or maybe not." Likewise, advisor Mike Sutton described to me landing a helicopter in a hamlet where they found a limp figure hanging from ropes lashed to a tree, the village chief disemboweled during the night. His wife had been less artistically murdered, their son castrated. My own point here is not to suggest that the United States and the corrupt and incompetent Saigon regime, which it supported, were the heroes of the Vietnam Wars. Merely that, as usual with all historical events, neither side commanded a monopoly of virtue or misconduct. We should pause before anointing the communists the good guys, as did naive young Western protesters back in the 1960s. It seems to me that while Ho Chi Minh's people deserved their triumph over the French colonialists, neither side deserved victory in what came afterwards. Let me recap the chronology. The French colonized Vietnam in the 1880s, lost it to the Japanese in World War II, and then in 1945 embarked on an almost deranged attempt to regain control in the face of a vigorous communist nationalist movement led by Ho Chi Minh. When Mao Zedong secured stewardship of neighboring China in 1949, he threw support behind the so-called Viet Minh. The French suffered soaring losses and defeats until in November 1953, they launched an operation to lure the enemy into a battle on their terms by fortifying a chain of hills called Dien Bien Phu. There, over the ensuing 5 months, they suffered catastrophe. Ho's military chief, General Giap, mobilized 60,000 peasant porters to manhandle 2-ton artillery pieces 500 miles across some of the most terrible country in the world to ravage the French camp. The saga ended in surrender of survivors of the 12,000-man garrison to the threadbare communist army. Through the last weeks of the siege, the French pleaded with the Americans to save them. There was indeed a faction in Washington that favored committing air power, seeing a chance in Indochina to check the tide of Chinese communist expansionism, which provoked near hysteria among American conservatives in those days. President Eisenhower and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, were willing to act, but only if allies, and above all Britain, would join in. And here, the government of Winston Churchill made its most important intervention of those wars. The old Prime Minister told the Americans that when Britain had been unable to save India for itself, it could scarcely hope to save Indochina for France. He said of Dien Bien Phu, "The loss of the fortress must be faced." Dulles cabled home to Washington bitterly, "UK attitude is one of increasing weakness. Britain seems to feel that we are disposed to accept present risks of a Chinese war, and this, coupled with their fear that we would start using atomic weapons, has badly frightened them." Had Churchill given a different answer, The Western Allies would probably have committed forces to support a hopeless French position. At the ensuing Geneva Conference on Indochina, what was amazing was that the Chinese and Russians proposed a partition of Vietnam instead of insisting that following Ho's victory at Dien Bien Phu, the whole country should be surrendered to him. The explanation was that following Western intervention in the recent Korean War, the communist powers were desperate to avoid an Asian replay. Beijing and Moscow told the North Vietnamese, as we shall hereafter call them, to content themselves with Harper Lope and wait for the South to fall into their hands when elections were held and the Americans lost interest. A hitherto unknown South Vietnamese, a Catholic anti-communist named Diem, who had ingratiated himself with the French and more important with influential American fellow Catholics, including Congressman John F. Kennedy, was installed as ruler in Saigon, while Ho Chi Minh's Politburo assumed power in Hanoi. The communist regime implemented its ideology with conspicuous brutality. Privation, oppression, and sometimes starvation became the common lot of North Vietnamese, though their plight and occasional revolts were invisible to the world. Amid food rationing, there was a desperate search for taste treats, which included stewed rat with saffron, grilled rat with lemon leaves, locusts, grasshoppers, beetles, silkworm larvae. No pet was safe. When 11-year-old boy's family was moving home, he hugged a cherished pooch he had to leave behind. Some strangers took it away in the morning, and I understood they were going to kill it. Dog was said to taste best if the flesh was beaten and softened before the animal was killed. In the relatively rich South, almost everybody had enough to eat, but the Diem regime persecuted its enemies, promoted Catholics in an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, and ruled with abysmal incompetence. Though both Vietnams became rival tyrannies, Ho Chi Minh's possessed advantages. He'd secured monopoly ownership of Vietnamese nationalism, heroic stature as victor over the French. The cruelties and blunders of his regime were concealed from the world by ironclad censorship. The war slowly started up again in the South, with so-called Viet Cong taking the place of the Viet Minh. The new guerrillas reflected peasant hostility to the Diem regime and spontaneous activism by southern communists rather than being driven by Hanoi or even Beijing, as Washington deluded itself. In 1964, the US decided that unless it dramatically boosted military aid, the South was doomed to collapse, which President Lyndon Johnson believed unacceptable to the American people. The following year, he began dispatching major combat units on a scale that climaxed with 500,000 troops waging a struggle against mostly regular communist formations dispatched from the north. The Southerners were supported by 61,000 Allied troops, Australians, New Zealanders, South Koreans and such like, and 600,000 armed South Vietnamese. Each month, US forces unleashed an average of 128,000 tons of munitions at a cost of $2.5 billion. Perhaps the most benign act of Harold Wilson's premiership, some say the only benign act, was to reject fierce American urging to send British troops to join America's war. At a cocktail party in Washington, Secretary of State Dean Rusk elbowed his way through the throng to a British journalist and poked him in the chest, and he said, "When the Russians invade Sussex, don't expect us to come and help you." The culture shock was huge for young Americans meeting Asia for the first time. Private Reg Edwards' first surprise had nothing to do with death and devastation, but instead with finding that even tiny children smoked, which seemed to him horrible. The first Vietnamese words I learned to say were, "Cigarettes are bad for your health." In the boondocks, many men were nervous of snakes, disconcerted by the gibbons shrieking in the trees. They loathe the ubiquitous leeches. The Johnson administration also embarked on an air campaign against North Vietnam, which hurt its own cause far more than that of the communists. The bombing united Ho Chi Minh's people as the earlier unification struggle had not, rather in the fashion that the Nazi Blitz had brought together the British in 1940. There was so little industry in the North that air attack made small impact. And although completely contrary to Western perceptions, the Russians and Chinese were reluctant to lavish resources on the struggle and had little control over the Hanoi Politburo, in the face of US bombing, Moscow dispatched anti-aircraft guns and missiles which shot down almost 1,000 American aircraft. In the eyes of foreigners, the war making of a giant symbolized by the B-52 bomber, which killed tens of thousands of Vietnamese, seemed repellent, contrasted with the courage of communist soldiers wearing coolie hats and tar rubber sandals, their women digging trenches and repairing bomb damage. In Hanoi, in December 1966, Premier Pham Van Dong inquired urbanely a visiting New York Times correspondent, Harrison Salisbury. "And how long do you Americans want to fight, Mr. Salisbury? 1 year? 2 years? 3 years? 5 years? 10 years? 20 years? We should be glad to accommodate you." As for the men doing the fighting, infantryman John Del Vecchio wrote, "For many soldiers, Vietnam was depression, despair, a valley of terror. Much of the anxiety came not from the enemy, not from the jungle. It came from being taken away from wives and friends and family and being totally out of control." Many firefights were brief. In one that lasted just 30 seconds, 15 of 35 patrolling Marines were killed or wounded. Often a handful of Viet Cong used their weapons for only a minute or two and then pulled out before artillery could work on them. Amid incoming fire, infantryman and later magnificent novelist Tim O'Brien wrote of the stiff thump of the bullet like a fist, the way it knocks the air out of you and makes you cough, how the sound of the gunshot arrives about 10 years later, and the dizzy feeling, the smell of yourself, the things you think about and say and do right afterward, the way your eyes focus on a tiny white pebble or blade of grass, and how you start thinking, "Oh man, that's the last thing I'll ever see. That pebble, that blade of grass," which makes you want to cry. There were booby traps, booby traps, booby traps, what the 21st century calls IEDs, and how they hated them all. Most were manufactured from scavenged US ordnance. A 60mm mortar round removed a foot, while an 81mm took off a leg and maybe some fingers and an elbow. A 155 round vaporized its immediate victim below the waist and almost certainly killed anybody else within 20 yards. Grunts engaged in macabre debates about which limb they would soonest lose. Most claimed a preference for keeping knees and what was above them. In 1 3-month period, a single Marine company lost 57 legs to mines and booby traps, which, as an officer bleakly observed, amounted to almost a leg a day. Among some terrible deeds, virtuous ones deserve emphasis. Texan Shirley Purcell was a veteran nurse summoned to active duty in 1966. She took a passionate pride in her work. "I didn't really have a political commitment, but there were American troops there that needed help." She was thinking, for instance, of an infantryman who triggered a Bouncing Betty mine. This young man had literally been ripped in half from his knees up and just below his ribs down. It was like hamburger meat. All the internal organs were just chopped up, but his legs were perfect laying on the stretcher, and his arms, hand, upper chest were perfect, and his mind was still very much alert. He was looking up at us, and the sense that went over that entire unit with that young man lying in the emergency room dying because there was absolutely nothing we could do for him was like nothing I've ever experienced. He looked up at me and said, "Well, how does it look?" I had to tell him, "It doesn't look good, but you won't be alone. And that was really all we had to offer him, that he would not be alone. Shirley had been a teetotaler all her life, but in the officers' club at Chulai, she started on screwdrivers, and who could blame her? Later, she could never bring herself to watch MASH on TV because her memories imposed a veto on laughter. Could the US involvement have had a different outcome? Many Americans who went to Vietnam were inspired by high ideals of service. A colleague recalled the words of legendary MANIC advisor, Colonel John Paul Vann, who devoted most of the last decade of his life to the war. John said that we'd assisted the Vietnamese to rise high in the sky in a heavier-than-air machine and must help them come down as gently as possible rather than crash. Asked what the difference would be, he said, there are more survivors that way. The two men once landed a tiny chopper, an outpost that had been overrun during the night. They crammed into the cockpit a badly wounded South Vietnamese soldier, then headed fast for a hospital. Yet the man died in the air. When they landed, Vann stood banging his fist furiously on the cockpit plexiglass, saying again and again, just another 20 minutes, just another 20 minutes, and he would have made it. His companion thought, this is a guy whom John never met in his life, yet he cared terribly about him because he was on our side. The anecdote is moving, and yet the American commitment was fatally flawed by its foundation, not upon the interests of the Vietnamese people, but instead on the perceived requirements of US domestic and foreign policy. An American prisoner, Doug Ramsey, once told his communist interrogators that he thought his compatriots' presence in their country was prompted 10% by concern for the Vietnamese, the rest by determination to check Mao Zedong. His puzzled captors demanded, in that case, why do you not go and fight him in China? We do not like the Chinese either. The decisions for escalation by successive US administrations command the bewilderment of posterity because key players recognize the rickety, rackety character of the regime on which they depended to provide an indigenous facade for an American armored edifice. Yet great states, unsurprisingly, like to fight the kind of conflicts that suit their means rather than the ones they've got. America's leaders deluded themselves that all the cultural and economic and social and political difficulties could be overcome by an overwhelming application of firepower, as if by using a flamethrower to weed a flower border. Since this was the core policy failure, it seems to me wrong to lay extravagant blame on America's generals, unimpressive though some of them were. David Elliott, a wise American civilian who spent years in Vietnam, said to me, there never was a clever way to fight the war. General Jim Gavin, the World War II paratroop hero, was among those who warned at the beginning, if a village is fought over 5 or 6 times, a great many civilians will die. The whole pattern of life will be altered. As the war continues to drag on, we ourselves destroy the objective for which we fight. 4 million tons of American bombs fell on South Vietnam. And even before considering the consequences of bombs and shells, Washington's decision makers failed to recognize the cultural impact of a foreign host upon an Asian peasant society. A local secretary earned more working for the Americans than did a South Vietnamese colonel. Bulldozers and airfields, armored vehicles, watchtowers, sandbags and concertina wire ravaged the environment even before guns began to fire, helicopters to swirl overhead, and huge soldiers to purchase the sexual favors of tiny women. This was not a curse unique to Vietnam, but overhangs all military interventions in far-flung places, however well-intentioned. To this day, Western military commanders fail to understand the folly of sending their soldiers to wage wars among the people wearing sunglasses, helmets, and body armor that make them look like robots empowered to kill, impossible to recognize as fellow human beings. In both North and South Vietnam, wherever the communist writ ran, they propagated terror and confiscated personal freedom. For all the adulation heaped by the Western left upon Ho Chi Minh and his successor, Lê Duẩn, they presided over a fundamentally inhumane totalitarian regime. Yet its mandate seemed more credible than that of the Saigon generals. While few Vietnamese had much interest in Marxist-Leninist theory, many were seduced by the promise of a revolution that would cast off the yoke of landlords and moneylenders, expel foreigners. A southerner said to me, "The communists could ceaselessly remind us how humiliating it was to be occupied by the Americans. The other side had the monopoly of patriotism." A key lesson from Vietnam for the West's 21st century struggles in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, is that it's very hard to exploit mere battlefield successes to build sustainable societies. That fine American officer, General H.R. McMaster, once described to me his successes commanding an armored regiment in 2004 Iraq. He concluded sadly, "The trouble was there was nothing to join up to." Former Saigon correspondent Neil Sheehan said, "In South Vietnam too, there never was anything to join up to. In the absence of credible local governance, winning firefights was and always will be meaningless." Yet, if the war could not have been won on the battlefield, the US might have contrived to inflict less damage through the excesses of its armed forces on its stature as a standard bearer for civilized values. It's a common illusion that beneath fatigues, young Westerners fighting abroad, including the British, remain decent hometown boys. Some do, others do not. Soldiers are trained to become killers. Circumstances of combat oblige them to live a semi-animal existence. Many warriors come to hold cheap the lives of bystanders, people they don't know, especially when their own casualties are high. In Vietnam, soldiers were often baffled by rules of engagement designed to curb civilian casualties. One protested to journalist Michael Herr, "That's what a fucked up war it's getting to be. I mean, if we can't shoot these people, what are we doing here?" It's hard to fine-tune the conduct of half-educated young men in possession of lethal weapons who are, like most soldiers, most of the time, hot or cold, filthy, hungry, suffering constipation or diarrhea, thirsty, lonely, weary, ignorant, holding their nerves and rifles on hair triggers because only thus can they themselves hope to survive. Soviet and Nazi precedent suggests that merciless occupiers can suppress resistance by force. In Vietnam, the US Army contrived to be sufficiently intrusive and racially contemptuous, also intermittently murderous, to earn the hostility of the population, yet not savage enough to deter many peasants from supporting the communists. Americans burned enough villages to incur the world's censure, yet too few to deter local people from sheltering guerrillas. Excesses, while not universal, were sufficiently common to show that many Americans considered Asians inferior beings, their lives worth less than those of round eyes. It was a terrible symbolic mistake to enlist Vietnamese to shine the humblest American private's boots and sweep his quarters. In the later stages of the US commitment from 1969 to 73, guerrilla warfare gave way to conventional clashes between large forces, which is possible that the US Army might have defeated the communists had not the will of the American people and the commitment of many of its soldiers already been broken. Even if firepower prevailed, however, it's hard to envision to what good end. The Saigon regime commanded negligible popular support. There was still nothing to join up to. When a South Vietnamese officer discussed his country's 100-odd generals with comrades, they concluded that around 20 were competent and honest, while 10 were both monstrously corrupt and irredeemably incompetent. In the midst of a discussion with the Americans about how the morale of Saigon troops might be improved, one South Vietnamese general's contribution was to propose reintroducing the French army system of mobile field brothels. Arguably, the people of Vietnam had to experience the communist model, as they did at dreadful cost after the North Vietnamese achieved final victory in 1975, before they could reject it. The war cost the United States $150 billion, much less than Iraq, two generations later. Yet the true price was paid not in mere money, nor even in lost American lives, but instead in the trauma that it inflicted. The American people's belief, both in their moral rectitude and military invincibility, created by the outcome of World War II, matched by an economic success so awesome that it seemed only logical to believe that it reflected the will of a higher being, was sorely injured. A distinguished Vietnam veteran, General Walter Boomer, said to me, "The Vietnam War did more to change this country than anything in our recent history. It created a suspicion, a mistrust we've never been able to redeem." He said the great lesson he himself carried home from Vietnam was tell the truth. I myself argue that the overarching mistake made by America's political and military leaders was less to lie to their own people about Vietnam than to lie to themselves. Major Don Hudson, who commanded an infantry company in 1970, said of the disillusionment of US veterans, they thought they were going home with their uniforms on and their little medals, and everybody would be really happy to see them, and they found out that was not true. Another US veteran, field medic David Rogers, is among many who still looks back with profound emotion. The experience was huge. I had a lot of trouble coming home and going to church. I couldn't confess. I felt dirty. I'd been part of killing. The only memory that still matters to Rogers, like millions of his former comrades, is that of his own platoon. To be able to say that as a medic, I was there for them. Around one third of his people were killed or wounded. Living close to Washington, he sometimes visits its memorial wall at 5, 6 in the morning. I won't go when there are others around. To me, it's a big headstone. I'm glad I have it. Moments come back. Seeing a tree line up at Martha's Vineyard, I thought, that's like Vietnam. The prettiest sights I saw there were choppers over tree lines. Reading the historians, I get so angry with them, the people who ran America. They knew what was happening. We didn't. In 1993, Rogers returned to Vietnam as a guest of its government and was taken to the area where his own unit had fought. He found himself feted by former Viet Cong, who were under orders to embrace Americans because they needed Congress to pass a trade deal. Rogers found himself reflecting, if all these guys wanted was a McDonald's, surely we could have worked this out a long time ago. Modern Western tourists are disarmed by the warmth of the welcome they receive in Vietnam from people mostly unborn when the war was fought. This is partly because an overwhelming majority, privately at least, now recognize the virtues of liberal democracy, the shortcomings of the alternative. President Barack Obama received a rapturous reception when he visited Vietnam in 2015, contrasted with the frosty attitude displayed a year later towards China's President Xi. Visitors, impressed by the glitzy towers of Saigon, the natural beauty of the countryside, often fail to notice the harsh rural poverty, an absolute denial of freedom of speech. The rulers of 21st century Vietnam concede to their people some latitude to make money, but none to express political opinions, frankly, to debate the past. I write much in my book about the American so-called credibility gap during the war years, yet in Hanoi, mendacity remains institutionalized. A conspicuous lesson of the past century is that economic forces are at least as important as military ones in deciding outcomes. North Vietnam's dead revolutionaries would recoil in disgust from modern Saigon. The name Ho Chi Minh City is falling from favor and will probably eventually vanish in the way that Leningrad's become St. Petersburg again. Its glittering shops, temples of consumerism burst with brand names, jewelry, designer clothes. I would argue that while the United States lost the war militarily almost half a century ago, it has since seen its economic and cultural influence reverse this outcome, where America's armed forces failed with B-52s, deep aliens, and spooky gunships, YouTube and Johnny Depp have proved irresistible. Chung San was a 13-year-old boy wrestling playfully with a friend on a hillside in North Vietnam on the day in 1975 that his village loudspeakers announced triumphantly that Saigon had been liberated. He wrote long afterwards in a book entitled The Winning Side, "According to what we had been taught in school, this would be the end of two decades of misery for South Vietnam. I thought we must quickly set about educating its misguided children." Yet in 2012, that same boy observed, "Many people who have carefully reviewed the past are stunned when they realize that it feels like the side that was really liberated was the North." South Vietnam, he argues, has proved historic victor because its values increasingly dominate the country. As for Americans, veteran Walt Boomer mused to me, "What was it all about? It bothers me that we didn't learn a lot. If we had, we would not have invaded Iraq." Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. who'd like to ask a question? First question up. Oh, yeah, here we are. Microphone coming. Wait for the microphone. Here it comes. Yeah.
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah, you bet.
So firstly, I'd like to say thank you very much indeed for coming to speak to us today, Sir Max, and for an excellent book. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. And thanks to next time you're arranging which yacht you're going to charter, make sure you charter it from Nicky Emerson, because he's the guy who sponsored it. Anyway, sorry, the question.
So the question is, one of the threads throughout your book is the inability of America to coordinate with the South Vietnamese an intelligence or a coherent intelligence gathering mechanism, notwithstanding the success of Phoenix. Why do you think this was, and what lessons are there for us today?
To me, the great lesson, which I keep up whenever I'm lecturing to military audiences, I always say this again and again, the lesson that runs through all our wars since World War II, is that success on the battlefield means nothing unless you can achieve some interaction with local societies, and unless you can achieve some sort of cultural and political togetherness with them in a way that we have failed to do in Afghanistan, and the way we failed to do in Iraq, then you can go on winning firefights till you're blue in the face and it means nothing. Now, this does not make me a pacifist. I'm a passionate believer. I'm only saying that the military aspect of these conflicts can only be one aspect. And unless you can get the cultural and the political bit right, the rest of it is just wasted motion and, of course, wasted lives. And when I've occasionally visited Afghanistan with chiefs of staff, that you don't need to be in Afghanistan very long, and even if you're on privileged term, one's very aware that they regard us as Martians, and they don't particularly like, not particularly friendly Martians either, that there's no meeting of minds, partly. No, I thought it was criminal that scarcely any British soldiers were asked to learn the language in Afghanistan, so they were entirely dependent on interpreters. And when I said to the then chief of the General Staff, surely, if we're going to have a chance in Afghanistan, we've got to have Pashtun speakers, and he said, we can't interfere with somebody's entire military career for months on end to learn a language that only applies in Afghanistan. And I thought he was wrong when he said it, and I think he's wrong now. Next up. Max. Just hang on, wait for the microphone.
There's a guy with the
mic. Hello.
Yeah.
You've made mention of two attempts that were made by the British to get, by the American side, to get the British to come on board.
Yeah.
I can remember very well because I was in the Far East at the time. But do you think, actually, that the presence of British troops would make the slightest difference?
Absolutely not. We would have just been involved in the disaster. Well, the other thing, the British have this peculiar idea that we understand counterinsurgency in a way that the Americans don't. And I've heard Americans who served in Vietnam, and also Americans who served in Afghanistan, who said we could stand almost anything on the ground except another British officer turning up and explained how we used to do it in Belfast. And actually, I would argue that the history book shows that although, yes, we have some skills, and especially some special forces skills, which may or may not be superior to the Americans, that any idea, I mean, the Australians, for instance, were very, very good infantry soldiers in Vietnam, who I've written about in the book, but they were no more able to defeat their resident Viet Cong regiment in their area than anybody else. Their tactical skills were far superior to the Americans' tactical skills, but it didn't change anything. But I think we would get on better in our battlefield relations with the Americans if we started out with just a little bit more humility and we didn't have this absolute conviction that we know better than they do. Yeah, towards the back.
Max, can you hear me?
No.
Oh, for goodness sake, this is the fourth time.
Okay, yeah. Now go on, try again.
Hello.
I can sort of hear you, go on.
Hello, okay, yes, I'll shout. It always seems to me incredible that in North and South Korea, half a loaf was better than no loaf, but it didn't work in the 1954 agreement in Vietnam. Was that because of the hopelessly corrupt nature of the South Vietnamese regime? And also, how did the communists come to hijack what was essentially a nationalist independence movement?
I only heard about half of that, but I think the core of it is this question about why were the communists so much more motivated? And if somebody asked me to explain in one sentence why I believe that the North Vietnamese won, who were a pretty nasty lot, quite frankly, they were Vietnamese. And this gave them a terrific advantage all the way through, that they could achieve a relationship with their people. And they did manage to motivate their soldiers and so on. What is extraordinary, all the way through on the battlefield, the North Vietnamese were suffering higher casualties than the Americans in any given exchange. But somehow, they kept going. It was certainly not, they had their deserters, they had their draft dodgers, they had a lot of people on their side who didn't want to do it. But somehow, they proved more motivated than did the South Vietnamese. But at no time, this was, the core failure of the South Vietnamese side, that the North Vietnamese did manage to convince their troops that there was something worth dying for, and the South Vietnamese government never succeeded in convincing their troops was something worth dying for. Who else? Yeah, where's the nearest microphone? Yeah. Yeah.
So, Max, I remember when I was younger in the 60s that we were sold the idea that the Vietnam was the finals, the domino theory. In other words, we had to make a stand then, because if that fell, then communism would sweep the world and we'd be finished. And so that seemed to me, that's how we were sold the whole idea.
The domino theory was very popular in Washington at that time. But actually what's amazing is and I've quoted in my book, there were a lot of smart Americans who realized even then that the idea that somehow the battle against the communist world was going to be decided in the paddy fields of South Vietnam, it never looked pretty credible to the smart guys. But I'm afraid, what is scary is that there are always some clever clogs who haven't read any history, and we see it even today now, who they read none of the history books, and they don't see that you choose your wars. And actually, the British government was very sensible about this, that even though Harry Macmillan's government was always eager to support the Americans, there was a clear understanding shared by our chiefs of staff that this was the wrong war in the wrong place. So I would say our chiefs of staff did not subscribe to the domino theory even in the late 50s or early 60s. But there were two parallel naive theses in those days. One was all those kids who plastered their rooms at college with pictures of Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong and Che Guevara among the 20th century's notable mass murderers. Yes, absolutely. And the other sort of naivety was the naivety of those who thought that somehow you could defeat Mao Zedong in the paddy fields of South Vietnam. And one thing that was a revelation to me researching this book, The Russians and the Chinese didn't want this war any more than the Americans did, but they felt obliged to support their socialist brethren. Where have we got to? Towards the back. We ought to do a bit more towards the back.
Thank you very much indeed. When would you say it was that the American military brass realized this was not going to succeed? And how much of a time difference, if any, was there between that and the political brass in Washington?
There were always some clever soldiers who saw that. The trouble is, one of the great virtues of soldiers, whether British soldiers or American soldiers, is the can-do spirit. That when the military says, can you win this war? They're terribly embarrassed to say, well, actually, no, because then the politicians are likely to start saying, well, what are we paying all this money for defense for? And this is what happened in Helmand Province 10 years ago, when some of us saw from the beginning that the idea of sending a brigade, a single British brigade, to see off the Taliban in Helmand Province was obviously a completely doomed venture. But I remember the chief of staff at the time saying to me, when I said this is ridiculous, he said, but what do you want me to do? Go in there and say to Tony Blair, it can't be done? Of course we can't do that. So this can-do spirit, I'm afraid, always pervades militaries. And all the way through, what was scary was that there were still American generals all the way through who said, just a few more tens of thousands of men, just a few more B-52 strikes, this, that, and the other, and we can do this. And one of my arguments, I don't believe the military should ever be in sole command of a theatre of operations of this kind. I think it's essential to maintain military command. I think it was wrong, although it was a war in Vietnam, I think it was quite wrong that first Westmoreland and then Abrams were in military command. These are generals. They're just trying to do this militarily. Why should they be expected to understand all the nuances of the politics? So I would never leave a general, however talented, in command of a complex theater of operations, whether it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Syria or whatever, because soldiers' special skill is ultimately to kill people. And this is a very useful skill, but you don't put them in charge of very complex situations. This lady has got a hand up. Oh, sorry, there's one at the back, and then this lady.
Hello.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have any thoughts about the difference in outcome between Malaya and Vietnam.
Well, that was the bit that the British would go up from Malaya to Saigon and sit in the bars explaining to these wretched, hapless Americans how they got it right in Malaya. Well, actually, the Malayan situation was not comparable. It was much smaller, and it was essentially a racial conflict. They were dealing with a Chinese minority, communists in Malaya, whom the Malay people loathed. And also, the British had made it plain that they were going to get out. And although, yes, the British tactically did do some stuff very well in Malaya, any idea it was comparable? I mean, the scale of it all, it was tiny, the scale of it all in Malaya, compared with the scale of what they were doing in... and most, all counterinsurgencies are different. They've got certain things in common. But I say it was a common delusion among British soldiers at the time. Well, you know, we saw off all those Chi Coms in Malaya, but there were never more than a fraction of the numbers that there were in communists in South Vietnam. And this lady has had her hand up for hours, and I'm most anxious to.
Thank you. What lessons, if any, do you feel that the Vietnam War should have on today's leaders in terms of attitudes towards the Korean situation, North and South Korea today, if any?
Well, the first lesson is to be very careful of military solutions and to be very careful of saber-rattling on the Korean Peninsula. The people best equipped to sort out the Korean situation are the Chinese. And really, what should be going on is the Americans, by any means, trying to persuade the Chinese to sort out the North Korea situation, because they're their neighbours, they're the key to the whole issue. But to start a war in that peninsula, if we can go to any lengths to avoid it. And one is terrified by the willingness of some American politicians and some American generals to pretend. You're dealing with it as with Iran. These are situations. It's so easy to start these things and so incredibly difficult to stop them again. And it's been often said by much cleverer people than me in the context of Iran that if there's a war between the United States and Iran, the whole of the Middle East is going to explode into flames. And the willingness of people who should know better to play with matches, and some British people even, to try and in the corridors of power to support there, I just think this is a terribly dangerous game to play. War is the last resort, and I say I'm not a pacifist, but I've written too much about wars and seen too many wars to believe that war should ever be a first resort. Yeah, sorry, one at the back, all right, okay.
So Max, this is a question worth waiting for. Thank you for a great talk. Bearing in mind your very long and illustrious career in war journalism, I'm wondering whether the Vietnam War particularly holds a place in your head and your heart. And if it does, is it for all the right or the wrong reasons?
Truthful, I'm ashamed in many ways of a lot that happened to me in Vietnam. When I first went there, I was 24 in 1970, and I thought I yearned for adventures, and I, like many young war correspondents in all generations, I thought the fact somebody was willing to pay me to fly around Huey helicopters and dine in all these wonderful riverside restaurants in Saigon, I thought this was heaven. And once a month we went up and stayed at the Mandarin in Hong Kong for R&R, which in those days I could no more have paid the bill at the Mandarin than fly to the moon. And then at the end, I always have the memory, I told my newspaper that I would stay to report the communists coming, and I reported the last 2 months of the campaigns. And on the final day, when the Evening Standard were running a headline, Hastings stays to report fall of stricken city, in the middle of that afternoon, I decided I can't go through with this, and I ran to the American embassy and fought my way through the mob around the embassy, and Marines pulled me over the wall, and that night I went out the American fleet. So I bottled out, and it was probably one of my most inglorious moments as a correspondent. So I have many, many memories of Vietnam, but many of them are not proud ones. So journalists, I'm sure you've figured this out by now, generally speaking, journalists like to portray ourselves sometimes in a heroic light. Very few journalists ever deserve. We do the best we can to tell the story as it is. But journalists who write about themselves and their dispatches and try and present themselves as heroes, most of what we do, I did a television program about war corresponding a year or so ago with Christine Annenpore and John Snow and John Simpson. And John Snow and Christine Annenpore said that they did it to bring truth to the world and so on. And I said, well, shouldn't we also accept the fact we're all rather handsomely paid for doing this? And also, egos come into all this. Couldn't we admit that we've got four of the larger egos on the planet in this studio? But actually, I have to say, it was simply pure to me. It wouldn't give me an inch of ground about that. But I stick with my view that war correspondents do a very necessary job, but many of us are driven by not terribly noble and rather selfish motives. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.